All right. This is Greek and Plain English, Class 1, so that we can keep track of the stuff. Yeah, I'm just going to put these down on the chairs. You guys can grab them as you like, and if you need to pass them around. That way you won't have to storm the main table here. In the notebook is a syllabus. And we'll kind of go over that here so you can get an idea of what you're signing up for. The class is called Greek and Plain English. I kind of came up with that years ago because it really isn't, it's not like a first-year Greek class that you would get if you went to a seminary or a Bible college. It's sort of an introduction to Greek. But it's teaching Greek in a way that hopefully is understandable, teaching it in plain English. That's the idea behind this. So if you're expecting like a
is this the meetup?
This is forensic accounting.
Oh.
No, it's Greek and plain English. So
it's Greek?
Greek and plain English.
This is what I'm looking for.
Okay. See, you say Greek and people just run for the hills. I taught Greek for a number of years at a graduate seminary. So you have all these young bucks coming in, they're going to be pastors. And they would come in, they'd sit down there in the class, and they know they had two semesters of me, right? 32 weeks of Greek. And I always said, I know you're here for the same reason people go to a dentist. You really don't want to, but you know you probably have to. So that's the reason why they're here. So usually when you say, oh, it's a Greek class, they go, oh, thank you very much, I'm going to go over here. Okay. So this is a general introduction to the Greek language. We've got three goals primarily for the class. Well, actually four. One is that you're going to learn the Greek alphabet. You're going to learn how to read and pronounce New Testament Greek, Koine Greek. With the goal from doing that is that you can read a New Testament, an interlinear New Testament. For those of you that aren't familiar, an interlinear New Testament has the Greek text on one line. Right below it, it has a literal translation in English of what the Greek text says. And then usually, like this one in the margin, will have a modern English translation as well. Because a literal translation of Greek sometimes doesn't get anywhere close to what we would expect to hear in English. So it's our goal is to learn to read and pronounce the Greek language so you can use a Greek interlinear New Testament. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about all those big grammatical terms that show up when you study a language, so that when you're listening to a sermon or you're reading a commentary or something and they start saying, well, this is important because Paul used the periphrastic construction here, you'll know what a periphrastic construction means and you'll go, oh, now I see why that's important. So we're going to talk about the grammar. We're going to talk a lot about language in hopefully a really non-scary, non-threatening way. This is not high school English where you'll have to talk about the difference between gerunds and participles in English. Okay, we're gonna talk about the grammar. We're gonna learn the technical terms, but do it in a way that's hopefully pretty understandable and easy to go. And then the final thing, the whole purpose of doing that, is so that we can better understand the New Testament. And the word that we use is exegesis, okay? It means that we'll be better able to go into the text and understand what the text says. Exegesis is the science or the art or the practice of going into the text and really, what does it actually say? What was the author's intent? What do the words actually say here? A lot of times in church, we talk about theology. And ideally, the way life should work in church, or outside of church, is that you read the text, and you see what the author, what Paul says, what John says, whatever. And then once you understand that, from that knowledge, you now create your theology. Unfortunately, and we're all guilty of this, I'll say amen to this, I do this myself. Frequently, you sort of create your theology, and then you go, oh, I'm going to go find that in the Bible. And then you open up the Bible, and you look for a passage, and you go, whoa, that's great, that agrees with me. Hopefully, what we'll learn out of this class is to do it the correct way, to get the exegesis first, and then we can do our theology later. The downside to that is that sometimes you find out the text says stuff, and you go, whoa. Yeah, I wish it didn't say that. I was really more comfortable doing it this way. So, but I believe strongly that everything is driven by the text. So that's how I teach, and that's what our goal is, to be able to read the interlinear New Testament, to understand the grammatical terms, so that we can be better at understanding what the New Testament says. And this stuff slops over into if you take a Hebrew class as well. Exegesis is exegesis, language is language. We happen to be focusing on Greek here, but if you take Hebrew or Aramaic, for the tiny little part of the Bible that's Aramaic, the same things would apply. You'd just be plugging in a different language. Okay, that's pretty straightforward, right? You guys kind of get that? Okay. A class is 15 weeks long. Bob says that Hadavar classes are always taught until completion. He doesn't want to make his teachers forced into only fitting, you have to be done by this date. I'm not completely comfortable with that. Don't give me an open-ended date. I don't want to do that. I think it's easier for me, and I think more faithful to your time, if I tell you this is going to take X amount of weeks to get through. And I'm telling you this is going to take 15 weeks to get through. So after tonight, you only got 14 left. So you can see in your notebook there's a schedule for the classes. If you notice, the topic of that class is there. That's generally what I'm going to talk about that night. It may be that some of the previous class bleeds over. It may be that we have something pretty easy, we get through it quick, we start on the next thing. But in general, these will be the topics. But you'll also notice on the left-hand side, there's a New Testament reading column. On those nights, starting with our third class, we're going to look at those particular passages as a way to sort of see how does this learning Greek help us to go into the text and see what the text says. So it'll be sort of an example of that whole exegesis thing I was talking about. The good news is for this class, there are no tests, no quizzes. We do take attendance, but that's just so you can get your certificate. Everybody's on the honor system. If you don't come to a class and you make it up, that's great. Fill in a little blank in the thing. I'm not giving you a grade. You all have A's. You have an A tonight, and you will have an A 15 weeks from now. So there's no grades, no tests, no quizzes, no incentive for you to show up at all, actually. But the class is what you can really get out of it. It's hopefully by the end of this, you'll be excited about this stuff and say, oh, yeah, this is great stuff. I really want to spend more time with my New Testament. I want to understand some of these things better. And that's really the goal of what we're doing. But again, there's no quizzes, no tests, no grades. So pressure's off there, huh? All right. There really isn't a textbook for the class other than the notebook. But I would strongly recommend that if you don't already have one, that you purchase a Greek interlinear New Testament. I don't care which one you get. My recommendation is you get one that has an English translation that you're familiar with. If you're a big NIV person, then go out and get an NIV Greek interlinear New Testament. If you're a King Jameser, go out and get a King James, because you want to have the English translation that you're familiar with and that you're comfortable with. They make these for NIV, NASB, King James. This one's New King James. They make these for all the major translations. You can find a billion of them on Amazon. What's that other one? Christian Discount Booksellers, the other online thing. You can find them there. So get one of those. If you don't have one already, get one soon, because that really helps in this class. You can get by with just your regular Bible, but when we go, okay, hey, why don't you take a look at, and I tell you the passage in Greek, it's really helpful if you got it in front of you, okay? Two recommendations on that. Try not to get, if your Aunt Mildred has a family heirloom that's this interlinear New Testament that she got at her christening back in 1927, probably don't use that one. An interlinear that's more than 50 to 60 years old will not have the most current Greek text. Okay, and I'll talk about the Greek text here at some point, but it has changed over the years. It's gotten better. They're getting closer now to figuring out, boy, are we 99.999% sure this is exactly what the original New Testament looks like. But that's a process. The scholarship that's gone on in the past 100 years has been amazing in terms of the Greek text. So if you get an old interlinear, it may not have the most current Greek text available. Okay, so I'd recommend get one that's relatively recent. Certainly anything probably from the 60s forward is probably going to be good. If you're buying things that are from the 20s or the 30s or the 40s, it may not be as current as you. It's still usable and it's fine, but it may not be as current as you want. The only one that I would tell you, absolutely do not get whatsoever, no matter what, I don't care if they give it to you for free, which they will, is the one that you get from the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society that uses the New World Translation. Number one, and I have one of these, the Greek text they use is really, really, really old. It's from 1870-something. It's an old Westcott and Hort text, which doesn't mean anything to you guys, but Greek scholars hear that and they just roll their eyes. It's like driving a Model T down the freeway, okay? So it's a really old Greek text. And the New World Translation has one really good use, and that's for the bottom of your hamster cage. It is the world's worst Bible translation, bar none. It is dishonest. It is intellectually failing. It fails on the scholarship. I can't say enough bad things about that translation. I hope none of you here are members of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, because you'll be very upset with me, or anybody watching at home online. But it's a terrible translation. It has nothing to do with whether we like Jehovah's Witnesses or not. I'm just saying from a scholarly standpoint, it's a brutally bad translation. Okay, so just don't get that. That'd be the only thing I'd tell you, absolutely don't get. Get your Aunt Mildred's 1920 interlinear before you get that. Okay. Let's see. Who am I? I'm John O'Dell. You guys knew that coming in, but I'll tell you again. And pardon my back. I have taught Greek for years. I have a bachelor's in religious studies. I have a master's in biblical studies. I've taught Greek for a number of years at graduate level seminary. I've taught this kind of class, this particular class, Greek and Plain English, more than a half dozen times over the past several years. I love doing this. I'm reasonably proficient at it. So those are kind of my qualifications. I have a blog that I just started specifically dealing with Greek in a very generalized way. It's called goodgreeking.com. I would encourage you to show up. I don't get any money when you click on it, but it's sort of a personal ministry thing that I do. If you want to email me, you can email me through my blog, john@goodgreeking.com. The reason why I give you email is that occasionally you'll have a question, and you'll go, well, I don't know, he's talking about nouns tonight, and this is a question about an adjective, and I don't want to ask in class. And so I give you the email so you can email me and say, whoa, here's this passage, and I don't know what this word is, or somebody told me that the aorist tense really means this, and just email me, and I'll answer that. If you have questions in general, I try to answer them. If I think it's good and that everybody here would benefit from it, I may answer it in class, but I'll always try to give you a private little one-page response best I can. So feel free to email me. For those of you playing along with the home game on the worldwide interweb, that's the only way you get to talk to me if you're not here, so you can use that email, john@goodgreeking.com. I try to get back fairly reasonably to people that email me, but it probably will take a couple of days. So if you email, at 11 o'clock at night, don't check your email at 2 o'clock that next morning, because I probably haven't responded yet. Give me at least a day or so. That's how you can get a hold of me. That's who I am. I've taught here at Hadavar a number of different classes over the years. Really love this place. Bob Morris is a great guy, and he only pays me a little bit to say that. And I'm really excited about this class. I think this will be fun. Okay, any questions so far? We're doing all right? The class is supposed to take about an hour and a half. Tonight I think we'll probably We'll squeeze about an hour out of this baby tonight because it's a lot of this just, hi, how you doing? I'm John. Here's the book. Next week, when we start getting into the alphabet, that's going to take us a while. I will not make anyone stand up and read out loud by themselves in this class from the Greek text. That just embarrasses the heck out of people, and I refuse to do that. But I will encourage you guys at home to read the text, to say the alphabet, to say your Greek words out loud. If you're embarrassed by that, you know, go down the hall and close the door and turn the fan on and run the water in the sink or something and then say it. But a lot of how you learn this stuff is by saying it out loud. Here in class, we'll be saying stuff out loud fairly often, but we'll do it as a group, so nobody will go, oh, you know, I'm embarrassed by that. So, hey,
is this the meetup?
This is the Greek class.
Greek?
Yes.
Oh, we got the good name,
There you go. So this meetup must be a hot deal because well, that's like the 12th guy coming in here. Apparently, we got something better going on in another room. You guys picked the real slow one tonight. This room used to have a big couch over here, which was great until people started falling asleep in the middle of the class, and then we had to get that out of there because that just hurt my self-esteem. Okay, so what we're doing here, this whole Greek thing, I want to tell you my philosophy of how we do this, because I want you guys to understand kind of where I come from. I teach this class the way I think, and I teach you what I think is important, and the things that excite me, I want to see you guys excited about. If somebody else was teaching the class, they would teach it kind of how they think, and the things that excite them, they would, you know, and we all bring, as teachers, you bring your own kind of style and personality to the content that you teach. And to me, this is all about how we understand language, okay? And we just happen to be doing Greek, okay? But this could apply to Portuguese or Italian or Hebrew or whatever, Burkina Faso, whatever language you were learning, okay? But we're doing this with Greek, and language is amazing. God has created this, it's almost incomprehensible at times how wonderful this process is. If you think about what's going on right now, okay, up in my brain, there are little electric impulses in the synapses up there, right? And it's these thoughts I'm having. And those little electrical impulses are now sending little messages to the nerve system that's connected to the muscles in my body. And it's causing my diaphragm to move and the muscles in my chest to make my lungs press air out that then goes up throughout my mouth, and it causes my lips and my tongue and my jaw and everything to move so that this vibrated air comes out. And it vibrates and kind of flies through the room, and your ears, as you sit there right now, that vibrating air that came out of me now hits your ear, and your tympanic membrane in there starts waggling back and forth, right? And as it does that, that creates little electrical impulses in your head. And those little electric impulses in your head click your little synapses, and your brain takes all that vibrating air and makes it into words. So that when I say, the dog is brown, you guys hear, the dog is brown. That is amazing to me, how what's inside of my head gets inside of your head. That is an amazing thing. It's just incredible to me. And we don't even think about it, right? I mean, I don't sit here and think, all right, I'm going to use the definite article, the word the. Okay, now I'm going to use a noun. It's got to be an animal. A dog, okay. The dog, okay, I got to say something. I got to predicate something about it. I don't think that. I just say the dog's brown. And you guys don't think, whoa, did I catch that vibration? Oh, yep, there it is. Okay, I got the word the. You don't do that. It just happens. Language is about communication. Language is about me trying to tell you something, or you trying to tell me something. Fundamentally, that's what language does. It's all about communication. Any language that communicates effectively is a good language, good use of language. I've been married 28 years in another few weeks. we finish each other's sentences, okay? Communication at my house may not be exactly American Standard English. It may be going, hey, did you? And my wife says, oh, yeah, I paid the bill today. And, oh, okay, cool. Well, I've effectively communicated. That was an amazingly wonderful use of language in my house that accomplished what I needed to do. Is it formally correct language? No, it's not, right? Because an interrogative in English has to have a certain structure, and I have to fill in all the little pieces and everything. So I may not fit the form of English language, but it worked, right? If I'm sitting there with my son and we're all watching a game and I go, and he hands me the chips, that's effective language, okay? So as we approach this, we have to understand that what God did in the New Testament was he got together a bunch of boys to write down stuff that was hugely important. But all these guys that wrote the New Testament were humans. They all did language the way we all do language, and their goal was to communicate these things to you. So we're not going to sit here and rip apart the New Testament to see whether it fits all the proper grammatical structure. Our goal is to say, what was Paul trying to say? Okay? I mean, that's... If we understand what Paul was trying to say, then that's effective communication. Then we've understood the language correctly. So the way you approach learning what language does is two ways. There's form and there's function. Traditionally, form has been the most important thing. I don't know if you guys have ever taken language classes, or back a long time ago, like when you were in junior high or high school or something, pretty much what you got was paradigms of how to say the regular verbs, and then you got a vocabulary list, and then you got tested on that stuff. And you weren't tested on how good you could communicate in the language, you were tested on how well you can repeat the paradigms or read off the definitions of the vocab. That's form. There's nothing really wrong with that. We do need to know form. I mean, if you open the New Testament up and you can't tell the difference between, you know, an aorist indicative and an imperative, then you're not going to understand what Paul was trying to say. So you do need to know form. But it's more important to know function. Modern ideas about teaching language, different than, let's say, when I was in high school, put more emphasis on function. A lot of times you'll hear it talked about as immersion. The Rosetta Stone software, amazing software. I don't get paid by them, but this is amazing stuff. It is fully immersive. It's visual. It's audio. It's everything you can think of that dives you into the language. It doesn't sit there and say, well, before we can go any further, we have to learn the paradigm of the regular verb. It doesn't do that. It says, the dog is brown. And it says it in whatever language you're learning. And you go, oh, there's a picture of a dog and he's brown. Oh, that must mean the dog is brown. It's an amazing way to teach language, okay? Because it focuses on the application of language, on the function of language. I'm going to spend a lot of time in here over the next 14 weeks talking about the function of language, not so much on the form, okay? If you're interested, and you will be at some point if you really like this stuff, you'll say, but I really do want to know the forms. You know, I want to easily be able to look at the text and tell the difference between an aorist indicative and an imperative. Well, I'll recommend grammars. In fact, the best grammar that's out there right now for beginning Greek is Basics of Biblical Greek by Bill Mounts. This is an amazing, this is one of the best Greek grammars out there. I've used a lot of Greek grammars. I've taught out of this oodles of times. Oodles is not a Greek word, by the way. And this is a great book. So if you're looking for a really full-orbed first-year beginning Greek grammar, I'd recommend this. It's very approachable. His writing style is good. And in it, you get all the paradigms and all the rules. Okay? I won't be giving you the paradigms and the rules here. It's an occasional rule, but not much, because that's not our focus. So we've got this incredible language thing going on. It's all about communication, and that's how we're going to approach learning Greek. Okay? We're going to approach it to say, how is it communicating to us? What was John trying to say? What was Paul trying to say? How do we understand this, okay? And we'll use technical terms, we'll use grammatical terms, we'll learn what the periphrastic construction is and whatnot, but it's the form isn't the important thing, the function is the important thing. Does that make sense? Excuse me. Does that kind of see where we're going with that? Okay. Boy, if you were hoping to get to come in here every week and just luo lue slue luam and lue te lue, you know, and run the paradigms, I'm sorry, you won't like this class. But if you're not really keen on that, you'll love it in here. Okay, what is Greek? What's the language we're going to do? In your notebook, there's an outline of the history of Greek that I've done. I'm going to give you the sort of the 25-cent tour of that. Greek itself is not a Greek word, by the way. The word Greek is actually a Latin word. The Romans called anybody that kind of came over from where Greek is over into Italy, called them the Graeciae. And that was the Latin word that became, for anybody, Greek. So the language that all these folks that came over into the boot of Italy over there were called in Latin Greeks, or Graeciae, and we get it as Greeks. So when we talk about learning Greek, that's not a Greek word, okay? The Greeks called themselves, they were Hellenists. They were the Hellenica, okay? And they get that from Helen of Troy, who was, as we all know, the daughter of Zeus and the wife of the king of Sparta, Leda. So Helen of Troy, the Trojan War was fought over Helen, okay? She was, according to the story, she was astoundingly beautiful, so much so that all these men would go kill each other for her. And that's the name that the Greeks took for themselves. They were the Hellenike. And so the Greek language, they said, well, it's the Glossa Hellenike, the Greek tongue, the Hellenistic tongue. Okay, but we're going to call it by the Latin name Greek because that's what everybody calls it. So, but just you all know now that Greek isn't a Greek word, it's a Latin word. So, a long time ago, long time before the New Testament, the very earliest stages of Greek go back probably 1,500, maybe 2,000 years before the birth of Christ. The earliest stuff that we found on Greek is some inscriptions that they actually, one's called Linear A, and the other is called Linear B. They've been able to translate Linear B. They have not, as far as I know, been able to translate Linear A at this point. That's probably from 1500 BC, maybe 1400 BC, long time ago. Linear A was probably Minoan, Linear B was probably Mycenaean. If you guys, if you're taking notes for a quiz later on. But later on, the Greek alphabet kind of formed. I'll talk about alphabets next week, but basically what happens in language is you go from drawing pictures of things to making those pictures of things into pictures of ideas associated with that thing, and then later on to those pictures becoming abstract characters representing sounds. Okay, that's how alphabets start. I'll say that all again next week. But Greek started out after we got through Linear A, Linear B, and all that stuff. Greek was kind of hanging around there, and the folks sort of spoke these various kind of versions of it. And then there was this group of folks called the Phoenicians. Now, the Phoenicians were pretty awesome. They were an amazing a group of sailors and businessmen. And they created a language that allowed them to travel all over the Mediterranean and do business with people who were in all these different cultures and people groups. And the Greeks really liked what the Phoenicians did, so the Greeks basically stole the Phoenician alphabet for their alphabet. Not just the Greeks. Almost everybody traces their alphabet back to the Phoenicians who came out of that area. It is interesting, in English, when we say our alphabet, we go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, right? The Greek alphabet is alpha, beta, gamma, delta, so it's A, B, G, D, E. The Hebrew alphabet, aleph, bet, gimel, dalet, A, B, G, D, they're all similar, right? Because they all took from the Phoenicians. Well, it came from the Phoenicians. The Greek alphabet we'll learn next week, almost everything up to the letter upsilon came from the Phoenicians. The Greeks actually kind of came up with their last four or five letters on their own. But Greek comes along, it's got these very early inscriptions that were kind of like hieroglyphics with some vocal association. And then the Phoenicians came along and they said, oh, we love this alphabet, we're going to use this. And so the Greeks took the Phoenician alphabet and started to sort of create their own language. Well, I don't know how much of you guys, how much you remember world history, but the Greeks were fragmented, okay? They were brilliant folks, wonderful culture, amazing, but they were fragmented into these little sort of almost tribal units. We used to call them city-states. That's the phrase you normally learn in school. And all these city-states, and a lot of it was based on geography, they had their own sort of version of what would become the Greek language. And it was almost like different languages. If you were on one side of the hill and you spoke, you know, Doric, and, you know, there was somebody who lived on the other side of the hill and they spoke Ionic, and you guys ran into each other going through the pass, you might have trouble talking back and forth. Kind of like if I only speak English and you only speak Spanish and we're trying to figure out, you know, what the price of apples are, that's going to take a few minutes, right? So all these different city-states had their own little dialects, versions of Greek. Along comes Philip of Macedonia. Great guy. Philip gets left in the dust a little bit because his son was the really famous guy. Philip was Alexander the Great's dad. And Philip did the amazing thing. He got all these city-states together. And he really created this one great, gigantic unit that we know as Greece. And Philip spoke predominantly a form of Greek called Attic Greek. And so that's what he taught little Alex as he was growing up. Well, Philip didn't teach him. Actually, Aristotle taught little Alex growing up. That's pretty cool. Alexander the Great got Aristotle. You guys get me. So, sorry. But none of you will conquer the Western world. So, I'm sorry. Just telling you up front. So little Alex, he grows up. He learns Attic Greek. He goes out and he conquers the world, right? He takes over everything. And the brilliant thing that Alexander the Great does is he gets everybody speaking the same language. So now everybody speaks Greek, okay? And everybody speaks the kind of Greek that Alexander spoke, this Attic Greek. But what happens, and this happens all the time when cultures kind of meld into each other and languages overlay, is a lot of the local words that somebody in an area that Alexander went through and conquered snuck into Greek. And some of the other variations of Greek that some of Alexander's soldiers spoke, you know, a couple of those guys probably spoke Doric, a couple of them probably spoke another dialect in Greek. These kind of sneak in there. So what you end up getting is you get a real practical, everyday language that everybody kind of speaks, right? That became the Greek that everybody spoke. It was no longer called Attic Greek. Attic Greek actually ended up sort of becoming this isolated thing that everybody used to write big fancy literature and poetry. And it was thought to be the perfect Greek language. While in reality, the guys down at the local place buying olive oil and barley spoke the Greek that everybody else spoke. Well, that's the common language Greek. Well, the Greek word for common is koine. The language of Greek then that everybody spoke from about 350 BC to about 350 AD was Koine Greek. That's the language the New Testament was written in. So when you tell people that you're studying, oh, I had my first class in biblical Greek, I'm so smart now, you're actually not studying, there is no such thing really as biblical Greek. It's Koine Greek. A long time ago, folks reading the Greek New Testament, Christian Bible scholars, couldn't find some of the Greek stuff that was in the New Testament in the other Greek that they had. They couldn't find it in Homer or, you know, some of these other great Greek poets or Greek writers. And they thought, wow, that's so cool. God created this brand new language to write the New Testament in. And they started to refer to it as sort of as Holy Ghost Greek. Okay? Well, okay. Archaeology comes along. They're digging up pieces of papyrus and potsherds and all this stuff, and it's got Greek written all over it. And they're starting to notice that a lot of this stuff they're digging up in landfills and in little archaeological digs and everything is starting to look a lot like that Greek they found in the New Testament. And they go, whoa, wait a minute. The Greek of the New Testament isn't some sort of special Holy Ghost language. The Greek of the New Testament was Koine Greek. It was the common language of mankind, of the West at that time. God used the common language of everyday people to write the New Testament. Well, God didn't write it. The authors wrote it. Holy Spirit superintended it. Make sure I'm theologically correct. I don't want anyone taking me a test for that. But it's the common language. The history of the New Testament has always been about putting the New Testament in the common language, right? Nobody spoke Greek anymore after a while. Hundreds of years after Jesus ascended to heaven and all the apostles died and everything, nobody spoke Greek. They all started to speak Latin. So it became important to take that New Testament that was in the common language of that day, Greek, and put it into the common language of the latter day, which was Latin. So a really great guy named Jerome came along, and he did a translation of the New Testament from Greek into Latin. He called that translation the Vulgate. In Latin, that word Vulgate means common. He took the New Testament and he put it in the common language. A whole lot of stuff goes on in the Renaissance. Suddenly, Martin Luther stands up, pounds his little note on the Wittenberg door, shakes his fist at the Pope and says, "All right, boys, we're out of here," right? Protestant church takes off all over Europe. People start saying, "Well, wait a minute, we're no longer bound with this Latin Bible. We need to read the Bible in our own language." So what does Martin Luther do? He takes the Bible and puts it in the common language in his area, which is German. Up in England, great guys like Wycliffe and whatnot, they put the Bible in the common language that they had, which was English. So the history of God's revelation has always been, it started in the common language, and it's always, I believe, through God's providence and grace, been translated into the common language. If you look at great organizations like Wycliffe or the Seed Company or any of these tremendous organizations that exist today, their goal is to take the New Testament and to put it in the common language of some village of 20 people in Western Africa, or someplace in South America, or someplace in one of the stands. Because the goal, again, is to get the Bible into the common language. And that's historically accurate, because that's what God used to write the New Testament to begin with, is this Koine Greek, the common Greek of the day. That's really important. You know, we need to understand God used human language, and he used a language that everybody spoke. And so if we're kind of weird about it, we're taking a step away from how the process really started. We need to approach it as it is the inerrant revelation of God. I'm not demeaning that, but I'm saying we have to understand when we look at this Greek that we're going to look at, it's language. It was used for communication. It was the common language of the day. And so that's what we're trying to do. So that's kind of the history of Greek. The way Greek fits into, in general, into way it relates to English, you'll see there's a lot of commonality, but there are a lot of differences. I don't know the number, Garsh. I should know this because I go to a church with tons of Wycliffe people. I don't know how many language families there are. Have to hang my head at church on Sunday. But there's a lot of them. But there are these large families of languages, groups of languages that everything can sort of be categorized under. English is part of the group called the Indo-European language family. Pretty much every language that we think about is part of the Indo-European language family. French, German, Spanish, Italian, Lithuanian, you know, it's all part of the Indo-European language family, okay? Greek is part of the Indo-European language family, so is Latin. Hebrew is not. Hebrew is part of the Semitic, there's a Semitic language family. So it's outside of English, the Indo-European language family where English is. But English is not directly descended from Greek. We're actually not directly descended from Latin either, although a lot of people think we are. English is a Germanic language. When all those wacky guys in Central Europe decided to invade everything west of France and up into, you know, Britain and the Celtic states and all that, that's where a lot of the English language came from. It's primarily a Germanic language. There's a little chart in your notes that show you that if you want to see where that is. But you'll be able to see the relationship. While we come out of the Germanic language, a Greek comes out of the Hellenic language, and you'll see where that is. The type of Greek that we're doing would be within that idea of classical Greek. The Greek of the New Testament is going to be fairly close to what you might see in Homer or some other Greek things. Homer, the... the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey, the two of the great epic poems of Western civilization. If you've never read the Odyssey, read it. It's wonderful. Actually, you should read the Odyssey and you should read Beowulf in your spare time. Beowulf is the great epic poem of the English-speaking people. Beowulf is kind of like watching Lord of the Rings, just to give you a parallel. The Odyssey is just an amazing, and you're amazed at how many stories that we think of, you know, and little phrases come out of the Odyssey. The other one was the Iliad. They're both sort of parallel things. And those are by Homer. Homer is probably the best-known writer out of Greek times, non-Christian author that most people know of. It is an unfortunate statement about our society that if you Google Homer, you get about 6 pages of Homer Simpson, the cartoon character, and then you get one little picture of Homer, the great Greek poet. So, you know, you can either view that as good or bad in our march down the cultural tube there. So English isn't directly related to Greek because we're in different families, but we're all part of the Indo-European language family. So there's a lot of stuff that we might see that's in common there. Like I said, the alphabet will be similar when you're learning the alphabet. You know, in English we go ABC, in Greek you go ABG. They didn't have a C, they had a G there. And then you go to D. So it kind of catches back up. There are some Greek letters that you go, oh, yeah, that's like a T in English. Oh, that's like an S in English. There are other letters in Greek that's nothing like letters in English. We just don't have them. There are letters we have in English that they don't have in Greek. They don't have the letter J. So if your name is Judy or Jerry, Jerry would be a G. Well, that's the British spelling. They don't have that sound. So you have to figure out in Greek, well, what letter do I use to say my name? You know, how do I write John in Greek, right? Because there's no J. We'll look at that in the alphabet part next week. But so we have some things in common. Some things in English we do exactly like Greek. Okay, we have things that we say have to agree in number and gender, right? If I say Tom went to the store and he bought a loaf of bread, that makes sense. That's the way I'd have to say it in Greek too. If I said Tom went to the store and she bought a loaf of bread, you guys would say, time out. Is Tom there with some lady friend or some habit of Tom on the produce aisle? Greek's the same way. Greek has to agree in gender and number. So we'll always find in our Greek text that if there's a word or a pronoun or an adjective, it's going to tie back to something that's the same gender and number, with one exception. So we'll see that that's very common. But Greek does things different than English does. English, we only say no once, okay? I don't want to go to Greek class, okay? We only do the negative once. If I say I don't not want to go to Greek class, that means I really do, because when we double our negative, it makes a positive. To not want to not do something means you want to do it. Does that make sense? Okay. In Greek, when you want to emphasize the negative, you say it twice. I not want to go to Greek class means you really don't want to go in Greek. So you say the negative twice in Greek. There, it's different than English. The use of the word the is amazingly different in Greek compared to English. In English, we have what's called the direct and the indirect article, the and a or an, right? It is the book, direct. It is a book, indirect, right? Okay. In Greek, you don't have indirect. You just have the article. And people, all that drives me crazy, actually, and people say, well, now the direct article in Greek. Well, no, there is no direct article in Greek. There's just the article in Greek. And it's used sometimes the way we use the article in English. Frequently, it's used completely different than the article in English. Sometimes the article shows up in Greek and in places we would never put it in English. If I say God is love, in Greek I might say the God is the love, okay, where we wouldn't use that in English. That's something that you'll find in your interlinear translations. As you read through and you look at the actual Greek and then you look at the English underneath of it, you'll see sometimes there's a the there that never gets into English. Or sometimes you'll see in your English translation, there's a the in the English that it wasn't in the Greek, or an a or an an, right? We have to put that little an on the end of a because we don't like to make the stop that we have to do between our breathing to go from one vowel to another, right? We don't say a apple because we don't like to do that, right? That's not something that our English-speaking little ears don't like. We like to say an apple because the an allows us to keep the breath going, an apple, right? We don't go a apple, right? In Greek, that didn't bother them in that case. So we do here. Greek has its own little things. It has movable new, sticks an N on the end of words for a similar reason that we stick an N on the indirect article. So anyway, that's all the stuff that you'll find as you're going through your interlinear New Testament. You'll see some of these differences. But we are all descended from that Indo-European language, which scholars believe actually there was an original version of Indo-European language way back somewhere called Proto-Indo-European that was sort of the mother language of all these languages that you see in that little chart. And that's a pretty accurate assessment because they found that there are so many common words in all these different languages and common sound combinations that the only way you really could explain it is that it kind of went back to one common main language, which would be Proto-Indo-European. But that's Proto-Indo-European in plain English, right? It's a completely different class. Okay. Greek today, if you're learning this class because you're planning on going on a cruise, this won't help you at all. Modern Greek is completely unlike Biblical Greek. Unlike Hebrew, actually, where modern Hebrew is very much like Biblical Hebrew because modern Hebrew is based on Biblical Hebrew. Modern Greek was Greek several stages removed from Koine. You had a Koine Greek, then you went into the Byzantine period, you had the medieval period, and then you have modern Greek. And modern Greek actually has two forms. There's the formal version of it that's used for the Greek Orthodox Church and for all government functions. And then there's the common Greek that you would have if you went on a cruise and you were trying to ask where the restroom is in the restaurant. You would be using the common Greek. Not unlike what was occurring in the first century, where you had the common Greek that the New Testament was written in, you had this formal Greek. But modern Greek differs in a lot of ways. The pronunciation of the words is different. There's some of the sounds. There's a particular hard K sort of sound in Koine Greek that in modern Greek it's now an F sound. So if you said Eucharistou, Eucharisteo, and nowadays you would say Eucharisteo. So you would sound strange to their ears if you were speaking Biblical Greek. I always tell folks it would be sort of like if I came in here and suddenly started speaking in Chaucerian English. I don't know if you're familiar with Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales. It's even harder to understand, I think, than Shakespearean, than that Elizabethan English that we're all, you know, when we want to mock old-timey stuff, we say, oh, forsooth, dost thou want to go sup with me? You know, we speak this sort of old kind of English. Well, Chaucerian English, a little bit further removed from that. But that's how you would sound if you were speaking Koine Greek to a modern Greek speaker, okay? So you don't want to think that this helps you in that way. The grammar's different, vocab's a little different. So this is not modern Greek. I would recommend you go get Rosetta Stone if you want to learn modern Greek because you're going on a cruise. If you're in a Greek Orthodox church, you already know Greek. So, because that's part of your religious instruction, right? Just like if you grew up a good Catholic boy like I did, you know Latin. So it's because that was your religious language. The New Testament period was very similar to our American religious experience in around the time of the Great Immigration, the 20s, maybe through the 40s. And the New Testament time, Jesus and the boys probably spoke three languages. Okay, they spoke Hebrew, which was their religious language. When they went to synagogue, that's in the Torah was brought out, it was in Hebrew. When they went home, and they were sitting around with Mary, and they were having dinner, and they were chit-chatting, and talking about that table old Joe just made down there in the shop, they probably spoke Aramaic. When they went into the marketplace, when they went to speak to anybody outside of the Jewish enclaves there in that area, they spoke Greek because that was the standard language of commerce. So they probably had three languages. It's very similar to what happened here in America if your family came as immigrants from Italy or Poland or Germany or Russia or any of those places, you had this family language, right? At home you would speak Italian, right? And then when you went to church, most of the immigrants were good European Catholics, they would go to church and they would speak Latin because that was their religious language. And then when they went to work down at the mill or wherever they went, they would speak English because that was the language of the country where they lived. So frequently you had families that were trilingual in this way. There was a religious language, there was the home language, and then there was the out in public language. Very similar situation to the New Testament time where most of the folks were trilingual. Aramaic at home, Hebrew at the synagogue, and Greek elsewhere. This would have applied to Paul probably as well. And we know Paul as a Roman citizen would have been very fluent in Greek. He probably knew a little bit of old Latin because Latin wasn't well formed in the way we think of it at that time. Okay, questions? I've just talked for an hour and I barely took a breath. I'm sorry. We're okay on everything. You got the notebook idea. Get an interlinear as soon as you can. Next week we're going to be doing the alphabet. I would recommend that you cheat and look ahead in your notebook and take a look at the alphabet this week. We're going to go through it in painfully slow process next week, letter by letter. But the thing to know about is most of the letters, their name carries the sound of the letter as you read it. So if you read alpha, that's probably the sound that A makes. Okay, it's like an A as in father. Okay. Here's the funny thing about teaching language. You find out how big an accent you actually have. We assume that everybody speaks English, right? Did anybody here have a different birth language than English? Were you guys all English as birth language? Don't be embarrassed if you have a different one. I don't care. As long as it's not French, it doesn't matter. I'll make fun of French periodically. That's just because I'm Irish-Italian, so it's, you know. But we all assume everybody speaks English, and we all assume everybody speaks English the same way. In reality, we don't, okay? I have a particular way of pronouncing English because of the family I came from and growing up as a little Southern California boy that's different than if I grew up in Wisconsin or different than I grew up in New Jersey, right? And we hear those regional accents, right? I'd be saying, oh, you guys, you know, if I was in New Jersey. I'd be saying y'all if I was from the South or from Texas. Okay, so we have these regional dialects and these variations on how we say things. Well, part of what you do when you teach language is you try to standardize stuff as much as possible so that we all agree on this stuff. So I would say alpha is pronounced as the A in father. Okay, I say father, so I say ah for alpha, right? My father, an Irishman, would have said ah, not ah. So he would say, okay, alpha is ah, right? So, you know, as you're doing this stuff, we expect that we'll probably get pretty close. But if your A as in father isn't quite the same as my A as in father, that's all right. There are no living Koine Greek speakers that I'm aware of. All of those folks died off by about 350 AD. Okay? So even your oldest relative probably didn't speak Koine Greek. So there's going to be nobody to say, oh, you pronounced that alpha incorrectly. Okay? So we try to hit these pretty close, but I'm just telling you up front some of the peculiarities of how I pronounce things or how you might pronounce something may come into play here. Don't get all bummed out by it. Just get close. As long as we're close, that's good. So look at this week if you want to. Start looking at it so it won't be a complete surprise next week. And we'll go over that. I've got some great recordings of Greek, Koine Greek being spoken. Recordings of the New Testament being spoken by folks who have spent a lot of time understanding what it sounded like. And that's kind of cool to hear. We'll try to do some reading out loud here as well of the text so you can kind of get it, because it's important to get it in your ears. You need to hear this stuff. There's a tremendous prayer in Revelation it's praising God, and I always encourage people, learn that in Greek. It's hagias, 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 kyrios atheos, apantokrator. It's holy, 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 the Lord God the Almighty, who is, you know, that's a beautiful prayer. And you hear that in Greek, and it just gives you the rhythm of the Greek language. It's wonderful. I'm big on hearing the language and saying the language. So I would encourage you guys, look a little bit ahead in the book of the alphabet. We're going to spend some time next week, but as we go through this over the next several weeks, say this stuff out loud. Hear the language. It gets it into your head better. And you know, the way you're supposed to teach, right? You're supposed to teach so you hit all the senses, right? And you hear it and you say it, and you're supposed to like shake your wrist when you write it or something so you get the kinetic experience, you know. And we all learn differently. I'm highly visual. That's how I'm wired. Other people are they hear things better, but we try to touch on all of it. But for language, man, you got to hear it. It's got to get into your ears. Hear the rhythm of it and hear how the words sound. And that will go a long way to helping you get familiar with it. So, okay, any questions on anything tonight? Anything next week? Anything at all? Why is there anything and not nothing? I won't be answering that here, by the way, because I have no clue. Okay, so then next week, same deal, 7 o'clock. We'll all show up. We'll start looking at the alphabet. Try to get an interlinear if you can. By week 3, I should know this. I've taught this class enough. By week 3, I think it is, we start actually looking at the text. Yeah, we start looking at Ephesians 2:8, one of my all-time favorite passages in the Bible. So we'll look at that in the text. So it'd be great if you had your interlinear by the third week of the class, but I understand Amazon, sometimes you don't want to pay the extra shipping charges. So the free shipping is, you know, that'll be just fine. It'll get here by the 12th week. Okay, that's it. Ha ha, good.